This is Ethan.
This is Nick.
And joining us this week is...
Hi everyone, I'm Forrest.
I begin every episode asking our guest, what have you thought of the return so far? But maybe we can just get the ball rolling even further here and say, what did you think of the return overall?
Okay, yeah, so... I mean, I feel like I have to talk about the ending first. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about over 18 hours, but... going into the finale, I had no idea how it could possibly end, and I never considered or thought of the ending that it actually does have, and in retrospect, I already can't think of it ending a different way. I think it's a perfect way to end the entire saga, which is ultimately about coming to terms with the fact that there are fathers out there who can rape and kill their daughters, and what does that mean? And I think with all the, you know, craziness in the return, maybe it's possible to sort of get away from that, maybe because there's less Laura Palmer in the series and things like that. But I think one of the things that the finale in particular did really well is really recenter the show and remind you of like what is really at the core of it.
I mean, Nick, what were your kind of concluding thoughts?
Yeah, I would say something similar to that, at least in that I have to kind of focus on the end right now because that's so on my mind. I mean, here's a question. How did we watch this episode, these episodes? Because I watched it at a viewing party where it was so crowded that there were people sitting in folding chairs, people sitting on the floor, couches taken up. And when it ended, there was kind of this collective palpable silence and kind of this exhalation at the very end of having made it to the end but also being extremely shaken by what had come, and talking to people as it was over and just kind of being on my own, particularly as I was going home from this gathering, discomfiting me in a way that no film, TV show, really whatever, has discomfited me in some time. And the experience of it is, it's hard to reconcile, I think, because we watched it in perhaps an unideal fashion, which is to say we watched it over the course of 16 weeks. And because it's kind of difficult to consider the fact that this is a show that had, you know, Wally Brando on it and had the sort of Dougie Jones conga line and also had those last, you know, let's say half hour, that last half hour, which is as kind of bleak as anything Lynch has ever directed, I would say. I mean, in a way, not just superseding Fire Walk With Me in that regard, but I think actually in retrospect, making that film all the more dark and all the more harrowing and upsetting. Because of what Forrest said, sure. I would also add that kind of the way that virtues are a flaw in the Lynchian world, and the kind of undoing all of it or almost rendering it for naught. So one person could, I don't know, achieve something that they had always wanted or had seemingly always wanted. It was kind of this just discombobulating thing, which I mean only as a positive. I thought it was fantastic, and perhaps I'll just pass the ball to Ethan now because I need a moment to sort of collect my thoughts. But
yes. Well, bringing up viewing conditions, I should say as always, I watched this as I did week by week on Crave TV. Shout out Crave TV. With two other people, one of who is currently in this room, actually, and you can maybe hear him laughing. But I'll just actually say, curiously, the Crave TV streaming quality was actually somehow the worst it's ever been this week, which was kind of interesting. Many of the nighttime visuals looked kind of artifacted to hell, basically. But, I mean, that being said, since I guess it ended a little under 24 hours ago and the time I've had to kind of sit on it since, like you said, I've had kind of a this feeling in the pit of my stomach that I can't say I've really had about any, like you said, any work of art in quite some time.
I'm completely the same in that. Sorry to cut you off. I'm completely the same in that I haven't really stopped thinking about it and feeling it since watching it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I brought this up on Twitter, but the fact that even the night trying to fall asleep after I had difficulty falling asleep. And then when I did, I actually had a sleep paralysis episode, which felt like almost, I don't know, a cruel fate, a result of, I don't know, but yeah, it's been weird even just going outside today and just feeling this kind of, I don't know, this dark cloud, even on a very sunny day, I'll say that.
Yeah, I think at this point we're just going to maybe go right into the talk of it. And I think it's perhaps appropriate if, or at least fitting, understandable, acceptable, if this is a bit of a non-linear discussion of the last 2 hours. Because to sort of jump off what you're saying, I don't know. I mean, I guess I've been thinking how much the show itself is kind of, it's about something that I've always found very compelling and something that I think about a lot, which is the idea of not just a personal hell, but a personal hell that you make for yourself and how much that can just come out of doing what you think is the right thing and doing what you think is all right and beneficial to you. And there's something about kind of the deadness in it, kind of that those open landscapes and those empty soundscapes and the way that nobody in the last hour or so seemed particularly human in a way. There was something about it. It was kind of hard to believe that these were actual people, more so than in a normal Lynch project. They felt sort of like ciphers of this particular construct, this particular constructed reality. And I don't know. It was kind of this feeling of no escape. And it's interesting too how I think that. I mean, I don't know about. I was kind of tricked by the end of part 17 because going into the last section, I thought we were actually going to get a happy ending of sorts, or at least a constructed reality view of an alternate timeline. This is partly because I, you know, had maybe done a little bit too much digging on spoiler forums about a year ago. And one of the, I guess I can say this now, I've made a point of not saying this to anybody for like 9 months now, but one of the most persistent rumors about the season was that it would somehow exist, it would split itself between like alternate timelines and envision a world where Laura Palmer was never killed. And that's sort of what we get at the very end, except that it's so brief and kind of the promise of it, this tantalizing promise, is so short-lived. And what ends up happening is, yeah, I don't know. I'm wondering if other people were sort of thinking that he was actually going to pull off this crazy sort of last happy hour of some kind.
The thing is, I think I've been saying episodes ago, I think we would possibly be heading into a very dark ending, just because what Lynch films actually have a happy ending besides Inland Empire and Wild at Heart, I guess. But
the straight story, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. But I kind of, again, I
decided. Oh, in Dune, because they kill Baron Harkonnen.
He is the Kwisatz Haderach. But yeah, I kind of had a similar experience. But, I mean, it's interesting kind of looking at, if you want to talk more about hour 17 in comparison to hour 18, it sort of feels like an extension or elaboration on the Blue Velvet kind of rug pull, in terms of you think evil is vanquished, but of course it still emanates from under the surface, so to speak. It felt like kind of an extension of that. And, I mean, even the fact that we get, you know, again, Killer Bob as the floating eye thingy from Big Trouble in Little China and a whole superhero battle, and then Good Cooper extinguished, it should have and all within the first half of the episode. I feel like looking back at it, you know, in retrospect, I should have seen that something bad was going to happen.
It was weird to be halfway through the first hour and think, it looks like they've cleared up everything. And not really know, like, maybe it's going to tie up some other loose ends in, like, this kind of fashion. But no, it doesn't do any of that. And, yeah, in retrospect, it was a dumb expectation to have even after watching that first half hour. Given what the show was about at its core, there's no way it could possibly continue in that direction.
If we want to talk more, too, about hour 17 going to hour 18, I'll even say, I mean, when... I guess you could say that hour 18 and the last half of hour 17, you know, essentially 90 minutes, a feature length, if you want to say, is sort of a film in and of itself, I almost feel like. And I'd say, again, after that last 30 minutes of hour 17, when hour 17 ended, we let the credits roll. And as soon as the Lynch Frost electricity logo came up, I said, this is the single craziest thing in the history of cinema. And then it upped the ante in its own kind of way.
You were in that revet mindset?
Yeah.
Yeah. No. I mean, it was a thing. This is another case, as I said with some previous episodes, where it almost sort of felt like we were maybe seeing, how would I describe it? You know, it's logical that there could have been an episode that ended at about the half hour mark of hour 17, which I think definitely throws off perceptions of how the narrative is going to unfold exactly. And that's one of the things about watching this in its televised format that I've found very fascinating, is how it's kind of screwing with, I think, our perceptions of how things are delineated across a certain set time narrative. Because we come to think of it as, well, if an episode ends with a certain kind of cliffhanger, the next episode is going to follow up on it immediately. Or if something momentous happens, that's probably going to be right near the end of the episode. Whereas this, it was a thing where, I mean, Alpha Coop is disposed of fairly early on. And in a way that I was watching it, I was kind of thinking to myself, well, there's got to be something else here regarding him and his sort of presence. And the way that it was brought back around, I think, was actually more disturbing than anything that we've seen from the character thus far. And that's because it finally gives us an opportunity to see what the virtues of D.L. Cooper would look and play and in a way sound like if it had been more ingrained in that particular form, let's say. Because when we get to the character of Richard, or I guess D.L. Cooper, but he's also referred to as Richard, and there's the whole connection to the very first scene of this series with Richard and Linda, here Linda being taken over by Diane, I found myself wondering if perhaps there was going to be a twist of some kind, where it turns out that the evil version had actually come out, in a way, because there's kind of this blankness to him, and it sort of brought back to me the idea that, in a way, you know, Alpha Coop is not so much the inverse of him, of Cooper. It's more just what was kind of always there and what was just kind of needed a few degrees to actually come out, or needed something a bit more, in a way, something less ideal than the original series, something less comforting and kind of funny. And even if it centers on, yes, as Forrest said, this, you know, kind of unspeakable thing, still, the coding around it has this quality of almost leisure to it, a breeziness to it. And if you throw that off, you know, how do people change under circumstances? And that's what we see here. And I found that very shaking in a way that I, even having watched 17 and a half hours of the show, I just wasn't prepared for. You know, I used to think Lost Highway had one of the most upsetting sex scenes of all time, and I suppose it still does, but the one here goes in right beside it handily.
I want to go back to something you said earlier, and that there's sort of this delineation happening between the first half hour of 17 and then the rest, the other half of 17 and 18. and it's for, as you mentioned, fairly obvious reasons. But something I think deserves attention is that episode 17, the whole of it, and only episode 17, is some of the most impressive digital filmmaking ever. Like the fight with Bob, where you know, just the way that scene is edited and the superimposition of Dale's face and the black and white and color, particularly as they start to edit Dale back into those Fire Walk With Me scenes, like that is formidable digital filmmaking, both like in the way that it's shot and also like the way that's like digital filmmaking at all steps, not just in shooting it, in a way that I have not seen before and don't anticipate seeing again anytime soon. It's a huge step above Inland Empire, which I love. It's a huge step above, you know, Pedro Costa's films, which I love in that regard. This is the way that he's able to work with very specifically digital means to do everything that he does in Hour 17 deserves some recognition.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, exactly. I mean, you mentioned the superimposition of Dale's face, and that, if anything, I feel like should have been the actual first indication, maybe, that we were headed into some, not strange, but dark territory. And I mean, yeah. Even him having the evil coot voices, "We live inside the dream," as in the very, very voice.
Here's a question, and don't be embarrassed to answer this honestly, because, you know, we're here now. We have foresight. But did anybody else sort of worry for a second that it was some sort of streaming cable glitch, at least initially? Because watching it, I have to admit that for the first maybe 10 or so seconds, I thought something off here. I mean, something is obviously off in a way, but to kind of the brazenness of the effect and how it is superimposed over not just shots that you wouldn't necessarily expect it to be superimposed over, but how it goes with sort of a more traditional cutting pattern underneath it. And how there is kind of this scene that is playing out, and it's how it would actually play out without that effect on top of it, which is not something that I don't think we see very often really anywhere, as Forrest was kind of saying. It feels like something that's genuinely new. The only comparison within the show I can think of is, similarly appropriately enough, in episode 8, when the evil Cooper is killed or shot, let's say, and the woodsman's mm-hmm. presence floats over the scene. Even shots that are devoted exclusively to another character, or sometimes him in his car or whatever. I'm wondering if anybody else had kind of an initial reaction of, I hope, you know, something didn't go wrong here.
I didn't in that particular moment, not with the face. I was having streaming trouble throughout the 2 hours, I guess mostly in the first hour. At one point, it actually cut out altogether right at the end of part 17. But even there were like a few like actual pauses, but I would see the time code show up because I watched on Showtime Anytime. And there was a moment a little bit after that where there's a shot that's held perfectly still for a long time and the audio continues, which I actually haven't gone back to check to see if it did freeze up, if my video froze up for a moment. But certainly he's doing, I mean, especially after that sort of assault between Bob and Freddie, there are a lot of unexpected edits in that sequence, and sort of it, on one hand, it seems like things are wrapping up, and then you have this sort of menacing undertone with the superimposition and everything else that I can definitely see thinking that, especially if you were having streaming problems. But for the face itself, I didn't have any issues.
Unrelated to streaming, but if we want to talk about face, I just want to give a brief shout out to the scene of Alpha Coop in the White Lodge, where we get both him and Garland Briggs as basically Lawnmower Man-esque digital effects.
Wow.
That was pretty tight. I just got to say that. Got to give a little shout out. But, I mean, if we want to talk more about kind of once we get Cooper sucked into scenes from Fire Walk With Me, Did anyone else get the feeling watching those scenes that that was, in a way, Lynch saying that Fire Walk With Me is my favorite of my own films, or it is, like, the ultimate Lynch text in some way?
I think his affection for it has always been very clear. I think him telling people that it was very important to the narrative of this new series was indication enough. I will say, with regards to that, that was one of those moments watching it where I went, "Was he actually gonna do this?"
boy, he gonna do it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because you're watching it, and the fact that a clip appears is not unusual. I mean, we've already had clips from the movie multiple times throughout the series, but when it's going and then suddenly it cuts to Cooper in the woods, and then somehow there's this reverse shot from his perspective of the sequence, and I thought, oh wow, this, okay, we're actually going here. And then another thing too is that, is there a little piece of unused footage from the film that's never been seen before here?
I feel like
where it's,
I was it, wondering that too. Is that maybe one of the missing pieces?
I don't think it is.
I can't remember, but I don't think it is either.
No, I mean, I've seen the missing pieces a couple of times, so I think I have a pretty good memory for it. And it's such a small snippet is the thing. It's so brief that if you had seen the movie, you know, I also re-saw the film in March, and I don't recall it. It's very possible I'm just getting this wrong, and it is there. But one thought I kind of had was if, you know, as Lynch was constructing the sort of alternate side film that is The Missing Pieces, if he had come across that footage and decided to hold on to it for the new series, because it was, you know, certainly in development at that time. It's the kind of thing that as somebody who obviously cares a lot about this and knows a lot about it and pays a lot of attention to it, that maybe only us real ones, as they say, can get particularly excited by that. But that itself was pretty amazing. And then, yeah, it's this kind of weird digital trickery that's going on with regards to de-aging. De-aging Cheryl Lee.
This is his Robert Zemeckis work.
that thought did cross my mind, yeah. Which I thought was very convincing. I mean, I was kind of looking. I have to admit, I was sort of leaning forward and squinting a bit to see the seams. I couldn't see it, which is its own compliment. But yeah, looking at it, there's kind of this feeling of, okay, maybe we are going in the direction of a happy ending. Maybe. that was, you know, such a high wire thing. And then when she disappears, it's kind of this question of what now? And Lord knows I couldn't have predicted where it actually does head.
Well, I mean, too, I think it was important that he specifically brought back The World Spins as the musical performance from The Lonely Souls episode. Of course, I think the episode where Cooper fails, you can say that, as a little tip true. Of the hat.
Something that I find really fascinating about the show, particularly in retrospect, because as it was going on, I'm sort of, you know, you try to connect the pieces. How does this narrative intersect with this one? Like, what's going on at the Roadhouse, etc. But all that stuff is deliberately, very deliberately, just totally ignored in the finale. And I think the function of the Roadhouse is really interesting because it is basically a space to develop the world of Twin Peaks and sort of create these parallel social spheres where presumably a lot of the same things that happen to Laura Palmer or other characters are happening. And I think we sort of see Odessa, Buckhorn, and Twin Peaks are all sort of sister towns in that, you know, they're small towns, everything looks idyllic on the surface, but underneath there's something sinister happening. Obviously, it's Laura Palmer. We don't know what happened with Carrie before Richard Dale Cooper arrives, but obviously we know that she was a woman in trouble in the same way that Laura Palmer is a woman in trouble. And he tries to, obviously he tries to take Carrie, Laura to Twin Peaks and sort of fix things. But one of the, like, sort of my takeaway, and I think what happens in the end is you know, whether you think it's an alternate timeline or it's really Laura, I think sort of on a metaphorical level, what's happening is that that character, that Cheryl Lee character, is recognizing that there is trauma in that Palmer house, whether it's her own or somebody else's. And there's sort of this recognition that that trauma exists everywhere and that she obviously had it back in Odessa. And what the, to bring this back to what the Roadhouse scenes are doing, is introducing all these characters who clearly have things going on. Almost all the Roadhouse characters who we see just for an episode or two are women. And it sort of expands the world in such a way that you know that these same or similar traumas are happening in other parts of the town or other parts of the world that are also inevitable and not talked about and can't be seen by most people. And I think watching the show, you know, week by week, I was sort of trying to connect it more literally. But I think in retrospect, I've gained a deep appreciation for those scenes and sort of the function that they serve in sort of spinning off the Laura story and making it more universally applicable, or showing how it is sort of the story that exists everywhere.
Because I think we've talked about on the show a bit about the politics of it. And I've been thinking about this, I mean, because it inevitably comes up, Mark Frost's Twitter account, but how Mark Frost on his Twitter, he comes off as like a America was always great kind of guy. And Lynch was kind of the Bernie supporter. And I think about how all this, you're talking about the sort of the trauma located in the Roadhouse, but I think of all this when we see essentially lower class people throughout the show, thinking of the trailer park, or even again, the new Laura S. Carey character. And if he's like kind of using that also, like he's trying to, but if he's like, because there's that line by the Log Lady, the glow is dying. But do you think of this show like, because you see, obviously he's saying that nothing has changed if there's still this violence that's going on, but he's also like trying to stretch it into a broader statement that he's also making it politically about America, but also, as you see in the finale, making it through Dale as, again, the male who tries to make, you know, someone else's trauma his own mission in life, his own pursuit, and the folly of that. Sorry, that's like a lot of like little strands I kind of glued together that you have to make sense of, but pick the one you like. And
well, you know, I was thinking about desolation and economic desolation a lot through the last hour of this show, or last, you know, maybe like 45 minutes, because you look at where the settings are, it's kind of a okay enough motel that happens have some very harsh interior lighting. You have this kind of weird diner that almost looks like it used to be a town hall place or whatever, with very few customers, and at least, you know, three of the five customers are these horrible rednecks. You have this kind of drab, depressing home in which this woman is living that also happens to have a man who's been shot in the head, sitting there with flies buzzing around him. You have kind of these empty highways with very little to appreciate in any sort of aesthetic sense. I'm sure Lynch finds things to appreciate in them, given his general taste. But for us as viewers, you know, it might be a different story. You have some gas station with that is kind of looks like it's set at the end of the universe, sort of, where it's blackness all around it, and the only illumination are these terrible fluorescent lights. And we're kind of seeing all this from this distance, so it becomes part of this landscape, it becomes the dominant point of this landscape. Then you're just kind of driving through darkness, and there's nothing around you except for kind of a suspicious car. And then you finally get back to the town, and even when you get to the town, you have the diner, which is closed, right? Some lights are on, but it's closed. And how often do we see the Double R Diner closed? Ever. Like, how often does it actually close down? I can think of very few instances in the original series where it's not active. And then you go from that to this house, and it just kind of looks like it's a normal, you know, whatever, like Tuesday night there. But there's nothing, right? There's nothing to define the house. All we know of it is what we know of the original show. The only signifiers, the only, let's say, let's just say it, the semiotic interest of it is the exterior, is what we come to associate with it. And I don't know, it was just kind of this thing of watching it. I mean, you know, it's also watching with a big group of people. I felt just this discomfort that actually kind of raised my core body temperature by a degree or so. I don't know if anybody else felt this. I'm being completely serious here. Watching it, I actually felt my body temperature go up because I just wanted to get out of it. Like I hated being in this world. It was so awful. And there was also this feeling too of this nervousness of like, how is this going to end? Like, why are we spending so much time on this one driving sequence, which goes on for 3-4 minutes maybe. And which I only in retrospect, I think as I was so kind of caught up in the moment, I realized reminds me most of, there's a little known piece of Lynchiana, but there's an episode of a miniseries he did for HBO in the early 90s called Hotel Room. And there's a segment with, I think it's Alicia Witt and Crispin Glover, that is almost entirely just a conversation between a man and a woman in the 1920s in this hotel room. And it's sort of like pitch black in the room except for this one candlelight. And similar feelings in it of they're kind of, nothing is known, but it is still certain that something is wrong. And it was kind of weird to see him in a way sort of loop back to that, because I mean, I feel okay saying that because we sort of talked about how this show has been in a way Lynch's consolidation of so many of his works and interests and little things he liked from each work, little things that he found interesting. I mean, I saw on Twitter, somebody even pointed out that there were visual references to Dune in this show, not this particular episode, but in the show elsewhere. And yeah, I can sort of feel myself trailing off here, except to say that, yeah, the sense of the world basically having been destroyed because this one high school girl's life was spared, I guess, spared, or at least it didn't end the way it was supposed to end.
I think what Ethan was saying, to sort of go back a bit, I think this is very plainly the most political thing that Lynch has ever made. And you see that throughout the series. You see it with Norma's argument with the owner of the chain, trying to get her to buy cheaper ingredients, even though the pies don't taste as good. When Harry Dean Stanton gives somebody money to buy food. Even like the whole like nuclear family of Janie E, Dougie, and Sonny Jim. There was some kind of offhand comment somewhere in the show. I can't remember the exact specifics, but there's a mention about healthcare or like insurance or something like that. So just like scattered throughout the show, sometimes more obviously than others, there's a lot of really, really like positively zeitgeisty political things happening in a way that, at least since Eraserhead, there just isn't in Lynch. And a lot of that, and Nick, I think this ties in with what you're saying, is that the idea of like small town Americana used to have like a bit of a charm to it, which is what Twin Peaks, the original TV show, was kind of playing on. But there's that charm is gone now. There's no anything there. There's no jobs there. I mean, if, like, the return is kind of depressing because you have, you know, 40-something or 50-something-year-old Shelley, just a waitress at the same diner. Lucy's still just a receptionist at the police department. Like, none of these people have had, they haven't gone anywhere, but they also haven't really had a chance to go anywhere. And hour 18, or like that road trip that he goes on, is just all of that charm of like small town Americana and the road and like the promise that it used to signify is just gone. And you're sort of living with Carrie and Richard or Dale and Laura as they sort of just go on that drive through nothing. And there is, I mean, what year is it? Doesn't matter. But Lynch is clearly, I think, making a statement about just the emptiness of exactly the kind of Americana that Twin Peaks is premised on.
I mean, in a way, thinking of that and the ending, in a way, this feels like the darkest thing Lynch has actually ever made.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, he certainly had dark endings before, but those tended to be more personal, whereas this has a way of feeling sort of global, I guess, because there's no, yeah, it's like I was saying, there's the sense that something in the world is profoundly off, and that there's no turning back the clock there. It kind of, you know, those nighttime scenes, it kind of, to me, it felt, I keep talking about the things in these apocalyptic images, because that's how it felt to me. Those nighttime sequences at the end, it kind of felt as though the world had fallen into blackness. You know, the world had been swallowed up by something.
I don't know if we want to go into this territory, but I mean, the whole summer this show aired, it was nice every Sunday having that 1 hour that on that evening to watch the show and not think about how it felt like the world was going to end every other weekend.
Yeah, no, I mean, I watched this, and this morning I went to the gym, and on 4 separate television sets, there was a story about UN meetings over North Korea, and how General Mad Dog Mattis has vowed that the United States can, and if necessarily will, destroy North Korea, will annihilate it, possibly with nuclear weapons. And then I was hearing talk of, well, you know, North Korea could launch an initial attack, that even if it's deflected, there would be a second strike on Japan or South Korea. And I was kind of, it was weird to see all that and to still have the ending of the show sitting inside me. It was a nice way of perhaps carrying over into the real world from this. It is funny how also, you know, as you're saying, yeah, it was a nice reprieve from everything for 1 hour every week. And then the ending we get is kind of spitting us back out almost into the world that we know.
What do we do now?
Well, Dice is only, what, 2-3 episodes into its second season?
Yeah. Well, I mean, my boy James Woods is apparently in this season, so I definitely got to watch it.
How does it make you work? Yeah.
Holy shit. Now I do have to watch this.
Yeah, I've seen the commercial for that many times. Side note, it is kind of funny how, I mean, I guess, Ethan, you didn't have this experience, but I don't know if you had this for us. I can't believe how much of my summer was spent watching Showtime, a network I have never spent more than 45 minutes of my life with.
Well, that's
the only time I've ever watched something on Showtime is if I'm home, like at my mother's home, I mean, and I'm just like flipping through the channels and there's some movie I like that's on, because, you know, Showtime tends to play movies in the correct aspect ratio, so that's a plus. And, you know, they have some good licensing deals. But just how used I got to seeing ads for Ray Donovan, I'm Dying Up Here, Dice. There's some show with Jay Farrow that's coming out. The last thing I tweeted, by the way, before the finale started airing was from executive producer Tim Story. And I'm very glad that was the last thing. I'm glad that was my one before going over to the other side. To get back on track.
Sorry, but no, wasn't that, was, we should mention, wasn't that David Nevins, the CEO of Showtime's, basically, he said that was his entire game plan, was to use all the attention from Twin Peaks to get people to watch other Showtime shows?
Yes.
Yeah,
that was exactly what he said.
I don't know how much that's going to work on me, but I will say I have seen multiple episodes of Ray Donovan on mute, and it seems all right.
I have no idea. I've never seen a moment of it. I like sort of like Nick. I can't recall ever having watched something on Showtime. I mean, I'm sure that like I've seen a movie on Showtime, kind of in passing, but I can't remember specifically turning on Showtime to watch something.
Oh, I was going to talk a bit about the whole sequence with Alpha Coop arriving to the police station.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of those moments where you kind of, you know, it feels like Lynch being very familiar with his audience. And the audience's expectations of him, expectations of what he might do, what he's capable of doing, sort of that, you know, boy, he about to do it. Sort of quality where you know, he runs into Deputy Andy, and then there's Lucy, and then there's Sheriff Truman, and you're thinking to yourself, okay, what direction could this go? And just kind of that palpable danger to it. But I thought it was interesting, more than anything, how short that sequence actually is, all told. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Part of what I think is it's kind of I think there's sort of a quality to it of the fact that were it not for divine intervention, which is to say the giant giving Andy this vision, likely that would have been kind of a quick journey through the police station for Alpha Coop, let's say, and kind of how it's something that almost needs to be extinguished very quickly. Then I guess one thing I have maybe kind of mixed feelings about is I'm kind of wondering how exactly I'm supposed to reconcile the character of Freddy with the rest of the show. It's just kind of strange.
Okay, I have a Freddy Please. Thought.
Yes.
Freddy, to go back to the idea that, like, these evils are being visited upon people all over in small towns everywhere and elsewhere in Twin Peaks, Freddy to me is sort of like the consummate powerless but good person, in that Freddy basically just follows his heart to Twin Peaks and he refuses to let evil have its hold on him. Like, it bloodies him a little bit, but unlike Leland and even unlike Dale, like, evil comes for him and he is able to reject it. And which is sort of like this moment of triumph in some ways. And I think Freddy is like ultimately one of the like most moral people in the Twin Peaks universe. Maybe not because of like specific things that he did, but ultimately when evil comes for him, he rejects it. However, it's insignificant. Like, one person being good makes no difference. So Freddy's able to reject evil coming for him, but its shards literally break apart and scatter throughout the land. So he sort of has prevented himself from being taken over by evil, but that evil still exists and is going elsewhere in the form of like the fragments.
Maybe this is me reading too much into this, but I almost thought I'm trying to think of if this is a commentary on the superhero craze and the idea of superheroes being, I mean, the dominant movie mm-hmm. genre of the time. And it's something he's subverting in that how we use the superhero movie to cover up the fact of how dark the world actually is and them as this post 9/11 thing. But I don't know, maybe that's, I mean, we do know, again, Mark Frost wrote the two Fantastic Four movies.
Well, we know a couple things. We know that Lynch is very vocal about the kinds of things that make money at the box office today versus the kinds of things that can't get made. So reading that as a total rejection of like the superhero thing, I think is plausible. In the same way that I think going all the way back to the premiere, some people read Tracy and what's his name, watching The Box mm-hmm. as this sort of absurd comment on, I mean, sometimes something as specific as recapping, but just in general, like this duty that you have, this pointless duty that you must perform, and the moment you slack off, like you lose everything. Just a bit like life under neoliberalism is watching The Box, and if you take your eye off The Box at the wrong moment, which is any moment, Judy comes out of the machine and kills you. So putting those two, like, I think if you look at those two, Freddy is superhero and The Box together, plus how political the rest of the show is in much more overt ways, I think that's a totally plausible reading that you're picking up on.
The diner sequence where, because I think that's the sequence where where Richard is kind of revealed as essentially an amalgamation of good and bad Coop. And we get the little, maybe possibly a reference to Dillinger's Dead with some handguns being fried, though Lynch probably hasn't seen that.
That for me was a scene when it was clear that Cooper is both, you know, good Coop and bad Coop, mm-hmm. which in a way, like, we always kind of knew. Cooper even going all the way back to the original Twin Peaks, is sort of like this perfect character. You know, he's like the moral, just figure who comes into this town to right its wrongs. And in the end of the original series, when Bob takes over him, it's sort of all of us are capable in some way of the same evils that Leland had. And he stretched that metaphor, you know, for another 18 hours, basically, of there's like a good coop and there's an evil coop. But ultimately, they're the same person. And the difference between them is really not that big. And I think the diner scene is what really shows that. It's, you know, he's protecting the waitress, but he's awfully quick to shoot that guy in the foot. And sort of doesn't really take too much, doesn't worry too much about the guns discharging as they go into the oil. And it's sort of this like weird moment where you really don't know. It's, you know, on one hand, it's just another side of Cooper, but really it's just like, this is who he is and sort of who we all are, where like the bad things and the good things that we're capable of aren't really that far apart.
Yeah, as I was kind of saying, it's this thing of you just need to throw off the equation a little bit and put somebody under pressure and put them in different circumstances, and that's what you'll get. And part of it, I think, is the kind of the sexualization of the character that we've seen in this new series, where he is having this, you know, consent iffy sex with his sort of wife, Jeannie E. And that's kind of plays this comical moment, although I found it very surprising in the moment, just because, you know, we've never seen the character in an expressly sexual state necessarily. We've never seen him, you know, mid-coitus, let's say. Mm-hmm. And to get that was kind of a jarring thing. And but then
definitely
here, as he's actually more cognizant of himself as he's engaged in this act, it's just strange to see him so kind of passionless. And there's kind of the sense that he's, even the way he directs Diane towards him, where she says, "What do we do now?" And he says, "You come towards me." And then, you know, it's just about the worst, just about the worst lay I've seen in some time. And, you know, in a year like this, that's saying something, am I right?
Oh.
Well, it's the last episode, we can say stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, To make a long story short, I guess I wonder, you know, there is a part of me that has to ask, you know, what now exactly with this character? Does he just sort of stay in this world that he's been made a part of? Or, you know, it's rare to see something that is both definitively a conclusion and a cliffhanger of sorts, you know?
I almost feel like the moral is he just should have stayed Dougie the whole time.
I mean, being Dougie worked out.
Exactly.
Well, that's the thing, though, is like, at the same time, you know, he was there. He kind of had it wrapped up. He could have carried on, even if, you know, even if we live inside a dream, et cetera, et cetera. The world was sort of at his feet for the first time in a quarter century.
Actually, something I kind of want to bring up about the last 90 minutes to an hour is how much Mark Frost do you think there actually is in this?
It's a good question. I mean, maybe this is his vision of a, you know, Trump's America or something. I don't know. That's the only reasonable answer I can think of. But I did see you tweet, Ethan, that there was, you know, significantly no Mark Frost in the last hour of the show, which maybe, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I say this in that I sort of, I'm dying to see the original script for this, because we know, isn't the rumor that, I mean, we obviously all know about how it expanded from 9 parts to 18 parts, or doubled, I should say, but isn't the rumor apparently that Lynch was the one who did all the expanding himself?
This is what I've heard.
Interesting. I don't know. I mean, I guess we knew that sort of in general terms, he wanted to do it in such a way that it would take this many episodes, and Showtime didn't want it to be that long. But Because I don't know if that which kind of suggests that he wanted to do the, like, he added everything, but
because there's a part of me that wonders if legitimately the original script ended at episode 17, and part of expanding it was Lynch basically adding that extra 90 minutes.
That's very possible. I remember when the show was, I think this was like right around the time that he had initially pulled out of the series, there was a rumor that what they were planning was going to be like a 2-hour premiere as we actually got, and then sort of a 2-hour conclusion as we actually got, with kind of the other stuff in between. So it seems clear to me that the last, or it seems very plausible to me that the last part of this show was, kind of a sticking point.
Do you think in a way that the ending is possibly the ballsiest part of the entire show, even more than like episode 8?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, because the thing is, I think if you are watching it and you get to episode 8 and it's not your cup of tea, it's like, you know, are you going to abandon it? No, probably not. Like, you'll still keep going. Or if you do abandon it, then so be it. But this is, you know, once we got the full picture, this is the final piece. And to not just that, but this is also very possibly the last thing we'll ever see of this universe. Except, of course, the Mark Frost book.
I don't know. There's a lot of theories that maybe 18 is actually the pilot for the next season, or the premiere.
Right. Yeah, there was. I saw some people saying things along those lines.
A bit of a coping mechanism, I think.
It really does tell you, like, for all the talk about how it doesn't, you know, he's not going to give you any kind of closure or like please audience. It really does tell you basically everything you need to know. I mean, we can talk about loose ends, like the, you know, the boy in the car that Bobby stopped, or like the girl on the dance floor at the end of episode 15. But I mean, the guy in the car, that's one thing, but like, again, I think all the Roadhouse stories are just sort of like women in trouble in escalating circumstances, because we have her crawling on the dance floor, and then the next one is Audrey. And even Audrey, I feel like we get some sense of closure in that. The way I interpret that sort of cut at the end of episode 16 is like her sort of coming to in some kind of a mental institution. Like, all the Audrey scenes are her own hallucinations in the mental institution, because it's white all around. She looks a lot different, which suggests that it's a hallucination. So, I mean, other, like, what happens to Shelley, or what happens to, like, we already know, like, Shelley is a waitress at the diner. That's what happens to her. What happens to her daughter? Well, Stephen presumably committed suicide with Donna's sister. Like, that's what happens to them. What more do you really need to know? It tells you everything. Like, that's what this town is. Like, there are tragedies happening all over the place. And, like, life goes on. And maybe you're Sarah Palmer, and understandably, you can never, ever get over it. What more do you need to say? Like, what details are people wishing they had?
No. No disagreement there. I mean, yeah, just the shape of the thing to me seems very clear, right? The point at which it works to very carefully and very insistently, that's what we got. I don't know. I mean, I will admit I did ask myself at some point, what happened to Balthazar Getty? You know, because he was in it for a bit, and then
Balthazar Getty?
Yeah, he was dating Shelley, and he kind of disappeared. Well, yeah,
I mean, that's what it is. He's like this drug dealer dude in Twin Peaks, and Shelley is falling for him just like she fell for Leo. Like, it's not a happy conclusion, but like, that's what her life is now. I don't think we need.
As Balthazar Getty, you just, you know, sometimes you gotta have more.
I mean, he certainly seems like he's set up to be a more important character than he is after that scene with Richard. And there are, like, elements of misdirection like that throughout that can be frustrating. And, again, like, the boy in the car, there are little things that are kind of totally unanswered. But, yeah, Balthazar Getty sort of, he does just kind of disappear, but if you think about it, we know everything about him that we need to know.
Props to Showtime.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, we can make fun of them a bit, you know, because some of their programming seems a bit silly, and we will probably never really watch Showtime again. But in the meantime, you know, what they pulled off and getting this to go through and letting it happen, and I mean, it's just I was thinking about the fact that I'd go to work in the morning and I would see subway ads for this thing. I would see ads on buses, and there was a billboard near Times Square, and I went to a free coffee and pie food truck right before this series premiered, with people paid, you know, dressed as double R waitresses handing it out. And what we got was this. I don't know. It feels like it was a great sort of a great Trojan horse in that way.
I mean, I think either way we can all agree cinema is dead. Long live carte blanche prestige television.
Well, I mean, if it lets them do 18 hours of basically whatever they want, you know, I'll become a prestige TV guy. I'll do the recaps.
But I mean, season 4. Could it happen?
I mean, it could. I mean, you know, just a few years ago, I would have said there would never, ever be anything more in this show, especially with the release of a Blu-ray set called The Entire Mystery, which I saw on my shelf this morning, and that made me chuckle. It's a funny thing to see this morning. So, yeah, I mean, never say never, but I'm thinking, no, maybe not.
Yeah.
I mean, I never could have anticipated this ending, but like I just said, I feel like I sort of know everything I need to know about this world. I totally want more David Lynch, more Mark Frost on TV. But hopefully something else.
On the air?
I don't know if... Yeah, definitely. Or I mean, on TV or feature film, wherever the money comes from. I'm not going to be too picky. Like, he made lots of great movies, and then he also made this. So I feel like, regardless of which it is, I'll be satisfied. Hopefully, I mean, maybe we should all keep our Showtime subscriptions. Like, if that's like sort of a down payment I have to make to get another 18 hours of something this good. Like, I think I'm willing to do that. I will budget that out if I need to. I just want the commitment from Showtime that they will get the same amount of independence on this on that project that they got on this one. So yeah, I don't want it to be season 4, but like, Showtime people, if you're so happy that we're all like subscribing just to watch Twin Peaks and you want to keep that momentum and keep that money, you know how to do it. We'll be there for the next David Lynch thing. One other thing, I think, like, if you know, all the right people are listening, Cheryl Lee needs some good roles. And I tweeted this, and I will stand by this until the day I die. Cheryl Lee has the best scream in the history of film and television, bar none. I'm sorry, Nancy Allen. You know, I'm sorry, whoever else. I'm forgetting that I had another name that I thought of this morning who has a great scream, but it's not as great as Cheryl Lee's. But even without the absolutely chilling scream that was the perfect way to end this series, she's an incredible actress, and anybody who watches Firewalk with Me knows that. And it's a shame that somebody so obviously talented, who has, I mean, the way her face convulses in that scene in Firewalk with Me where they go over to Harold's, like, one look at that scene, one look at the scene where she runs into the bushes and then sees her dad come out and runs off, like, you don't need to watch her for very long to realize that it's like a truly special talent. And like, she wasn't in this series a lot, but what little we did get from her was just a reminder of, like, everything that we've been missing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you want me to end the show with the Marilyn Manson song that sampled her scream from the final episode?
No. Yes, go for it.
I'm getting conflicting reports here. Do I do it? Do I not?
I mean, we have LP sampling the Do You Think If You Were Falling in Space scene from Firewalk With Me to open I'll Sleep When You're Dead. So I think we need more Shirley scream sampling. If we can sample Nancy Allen's scream and, you know, put it into a movie within a movie, we can sample the Shirley scream. Everyone must hear the scream. There's nothing else like it.
Mm. You know, it's funny. I actually found myself re-listening to music from the show, from, like, the, you know, performances, and I realized how much the Trent Reznor Nine Inch Nails song kind of is about the last hour of this show. I mean, I in a pretty pretentious kind of jerk-offy mood, I did make the lyrics to the song my Letterboxd review of the show, because everybody was logging on Letterboxd, so I thought it'd be a nice thing to mark the moment, even though it is really a TV show, but if you look at the lyrics to the song, how much it really is the end of the series, it doesn't feel like a coincidence. It definitely feels like there's something going on there. And I sort of thought it's almost like it's almost Trent Reznor inhabiting the mindset of Dale Cooper at the end of the series in a way that I found very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So, something I couldn't have necessarily anticipated. Definitely better than the Eddie Vedder song that closed out Part 16, which
could have been worse.
It was fine. It was fine. But I mean, you know, I know where my bread is buttered here. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I mean, I'm pretty melancholy about this all being over.
Seems like it was really only yesterday we started this.
I know.
Not that it was that long ago. It really hasn't been that long since this started. It was, you know, less than 4 months ago the show started airing, but...
it's just been... like exactly 24 hours ago, we were watching a Ray Donovan commercial that split up the finale.
but yeah, the extent to which this has kind of dominated the summer for me has been a real pleasure. You know, I couldn't have asked for anything else, I guess. And Ethan, it's, you know, it's what I said in the first episode. It was fall of 2014. We agreed that we would do some sort of week by week review of the show.
And we did it.
I'm very glad we stuck to it.
Me too.
And Forrest, thank you for joining us on this ride, at least for 90 minutes to 2 hours.
Yeah, thank you guys for saving the best episode. Not because it's me. I mean, that helps, of course. But the best episode because I get to talk not just about the finale, but about the show as a whole. And everything is so clearer. And whereas past guests were constricted by not knowing all that I know, all that we know now, I got the best episode. So thank you guys for giving me the best episode. That's awesome. I just got to talk about Twin Peaks. I didn't have to make any bad predictions. You know, I didn't have to talk about how maybe Candy is Laura. Apologize to any guests who might have come on and said that. I didn't have to say anything like that. I just got to talk about what already happened.
Thank you. Truly, you are the final stage in the expanding brain meme. Well, where can we find you, though, on the internet, Forrest?
Oh, yes. We can find me on the internet on Twitter at fcardaminus. Card men is, if you can spell those four words, you can spell my last name. You can find me on Letterboxd at Forrest C. And you can find me in the pages of various film-related publications sporadically, but nothing in the pipeline at the moment.
Yeah. Nick, where can we find you on the internet?
I guess one last time I'll say thefilmstage.com. Twitter.com/Nick_Newman and my various real world doings with Grasshopper Film.
Well, you can find me on Twitter.com/EthanVess and you'll be able to find me on the film stage quite a bit in the next few weeks as the Toronto Film Festival is starting up. I'll be doing coverage for that. And I have another Twitter account somewhere out there in another dimension. But it's up to you to solve that mystery. So, but thank you both. Thank you, Nick, for being on every week with me. Thank you, Forrest, again for joining. And thank you, the listener.
Thank you, guys.
Again.
Thank you.
Thank you.